Okay, we're going to continue talking with William Craig Reed about his work, Cold War III, and take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, William Craig Reed. William, your website, of course, you got lots of information there, and the book is now out and available?
Yes, it's been out for a couple of months now.
Great. Excellent. And they can still get Red November, the other book.
Absolutely. It's no longer in hardcover, but you can get the trade paperback.
Now, in Russia, is Vladimir Putin respected or feared?
Absolutely both.
Ah.
But he does have an extremely high approval rating. It's still upwards of around 80%, even given the demise of the ruble, a temporary demise. But he has brought that country from some severe economic situations in the past to a much higher per capita gross domestic product. They absolutely love him there.
Now, I've heard two pronunciations for his right-hand man, Medvedev or Medvedev, whatever you want to call him. What's he doing these days?
Well, he's probably trying to keep Putin from being assassinated by somebody. But The main thing everybody's working on in Russia right now is to get the ruble back up on its wheels because of this oil glut situation. So a lot of focus and attention has been put on gas, natural gas. You know, again, they feed about a third of the gas that Europe uses. So that's why there were minor sanctions, really, with Ukraine coming from Europe. That's a very delicate situation. Big $400 billion gas deal with China. He's cut another one with Japan. So gas is really where they're headed.
Whatever happened to the Soviet Union's push for Afghanistan? How did they get defeated by these Mujahideen?
Well, you know, great movie, Charlie's War. It talks about a lot of what went into that. But it was really the weaponization of the Afghans by the U.S. that prevented that from becoming a Russian territory, if you will. And today we are now fighting some of those same people that we equipped way
That's
back
right.
when.
So, exactly. You know, I wanted to, before we go to calls, William, I wanted to ask you about ISIS and their ability to sell oil to bank. Now, I'm convinced one of the other reasons why oil is plummeting is we're trying to squeeze them too. Your thoughts, though, on who do they bank with? I mean, how do they actually sell their oil and put their money aside?
Well, you know, they've got quite a few backers in the Middle East and sponsors of terror. Iran, obviously, is a sponsor of terror, but you've got many other very wealthy, oil-wealthy barons over there who are supporting ISIS. They've never liked the U.S., and they see this as an opportunity to get cheaper oil as well as unseating the U.S. from basically nosing our way into affairs they don't feel that we should be involved in. And so they're getting a lot of help from some very wealthy people in the Middle East.
We don't hear a peep from Kuwait anymore after we went in there and saved them all. What's going on there?
They are under wraps in the same way that a lot of the different OPEC countries are under wraps. So anytime an OPEC country has started to step out of line, the U.S. has stepped in. We, again, mentioned that as far as Iraq is concerned. We saw it in Libya. We saw it in Syria, actually. That's what really happened with al-Assad. And we've seen that in Kuwait. We're seeing that now with the way we're capitulating with Iran. They threatened to go off the U.S. dollar. So we take a step in whenever we see anything that threatens the dollar that undermines oil trade.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to Brian in Dallas, Texas on the wild card line. Hello, Brian. Go ahead.
Hello, George. And here's my thought and question. You know, you had mentioned that Russia is building a lot. They have a lot of advanced technology, the submarine, for example, but that the U.S. really hasn't been doing enough. I'm wondering if we are in fact working on some, you know, pretty awesome projects. One of them would be the tungsten rods concept. That's firing these tungsten rods from satellites in space, and it's firing them at such a high velocity that it could create the equivalent of a 2 or 3 kiloton, you know, blast on the ground. And then also, I've heard through the grapevine that we're working on some directed energy weapons out in places like New Mexico, at Sandia, that are able to be fired from satellites in space towards the ground and vice versa. So I'm wondering if you think that could make a difference here over the next 10 to 20 years and showing, you know, just how much more advanced and how much more powerful the U.S. is technologically than either Russia or China.
Good questions. What do you think, William? Do we have that capability?
Without question. I had the privilege of actually going to Pennsylvania, to Penn State. You know, there's the Advanced Research Labs, and they're working on some very cutting-edge stuff there. New designs for submarines that look like donuts that can use basically a new type of propulsion systems. And they can, you know, go hundreds of knots underwater. They build a force field, if you will, around the front. It's a cavitation type of force field. It's very interesting. But these new tungsten weapons, they're working on some of those as well. And, you know, these new control rooms for various different platforms that look like Star Trek, and they have the bridge of the Enterprise. There's just all kinds of amazing things that are being worked on.
When we work on this kind of technology, how many years are we ahead before it's used? 5 years? 10 years? What do you think?
Many, many years in advance. These are weapons and also other technologies that take many years. And part of it is funding. You know, it just takes a long time to build things when, you know, it seems like we're spending this ton of money on the military, but a lot of that goes into, even though they don't get paid a lot, salaries, and also, you know, we have retirement. I mean, it is very expensive to operate the fleet. They're the largest user of oil and gas. Huge expenses there. And so not a lot of funds are left over, and it does take a lot of time to build these things and to test them to make sure they work properly.
Next up, we go to Cornelius in Louisiana. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello, George. And Craig, God bless both of y'all. I'm the Bible Beans and Bullets man and the God Guns and Gold. So I want to ask your guest, does he believe in Bible prophecy, and will this lead to World War III? So God bless you, and thank you so much.
Sure thing. Go ahead, William.
Well, I think we're seeing that unfold even as we speak. We're headed toward what certainly looks like an Armageddon in the Middle East, especially with Iran having the shackles taken off of them. You know, it seems like they can pretty much do what they want, and they can, you know, take our sailors and take them hostage, and they can fire within close proximity of our ships. They can threaten us all they want, and then the very next day we'll take the sanctions off. And that feels like we're headed towards Armageddon. So, you know, open your Bibles and take another read, because you might want to brush up on what's really going to happen.
Yeah, that was a bizarre situation. It was almost as if they let them go because they really didn't have much of a choice. But it was a power play. It was almost one of those, see what we can do, and your helpless Navy folks are just right here. Unbelievable.
Well, there's some experts who believe that, and I concur. I get a lot of behind-the-scenes information. We have two Navy platforms that run on GPS, and we do know that the Iranians have GPS blocking capability, and they can also, they've reportedly been able to take over some drones using this GPS hacking technology. So speculation is there that perhaps it wasn't just an accidental drift. I happen to know some people that work on the SWCC boats, the Special Warfare Combat Craft, and that's a it just doesn't happen.
Interesting tech. Or you think they would have radioed for help if they really were in distress, huh?
Well, absolutely. You don't have everything go dead on your on your platform like that. It just doesn't happen.
Let's go to Andy in Norwalk, California, Wild Card Line. Hello, Andy. Good. Thanks for calling.
Great show as usual, George. Yes, two brief points to the guest. Number one, in your opinion, do you believe that there's a chance that some of the rumors about the port cities in China being blasted with tremendous explosions, which I've seen videos of, and the fires as a result of that, and tremendous damage, which some compared to a nuclear event, do you believe that was maybe the U.S. had a hand in that with our black box technology? And number two, with hundreds of generals, over 200 generals and U.S. admirals having been fired by our current president, do you believe the U.S. is in potential danger? Has he placed our country in danger as a result of not having the combat veterans who know all of the ins and outs of war being relieved of duty and upgrading men who are yes men in many cases, people without the experience, the combat experience? And I appreciate the show and your opinion. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting series of questions, William. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, a mark of a good leader is someone who puts around them the expertise they need in order to make the right decisions. We saw that with some of the best leaders in the world. We saw that with Kennedy, also with Abraham Lincoln, and so on. And they don't consider themselves the smartest men or women in the world, these leaders, and they find people who are, and they listen to them. They take their advice. Now, when Obama first came into office, he did have some advisors that were not that bad. They were actually fairly good, and he seemed to be at least listening to them. But when he took office the second time around, he did bring in a lot of yes people. At least that's what is apparently the case. And so now we're seeing some capitulation. It's extremely important that a leader not only takes that advice, but stands up strong against those who are strong. You cannot back down against the likes of a Putin. He will see that as weakness, and he will take advantage of that, and we've seen that happen time and time again. We're seeing that happen with Iran over and over. You must stand strong against people who do not know anything other than strength.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, he does sense weakness and reacts to it. Yeah, you know, when once he smells a little blood, he goes right for it like a shark would.
No question.
Brian is in Indianapolis, east of the Rockies. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, listen, we all know that Barack Obama is a very weak leader. Now, this Iranian deal, this $150 billion that they're going to give these people, what piece of the puzzle does that fit into? Because my opinion is I think that's the powder keg that's going to ignite, you know, a global World War III. So what, in your opinion, why in the world, and I'm calling the president out on this, why in the world would he want to give $150 billion to that regime that's going to build a nuclear weapon, they're going to send it to Israel, and they're going to send them over here? And, you know, and you know, he's been tearing down our military, and he's leaving us defenseless as a middle class blue collar worker. Why is he putting us at a risk like that? What's your opinion on that?
Excellent question. I think we did talk a little bit about that earlier. The real reason why we had to back down in Iran, or why I should say Obama felt he had to back down in Iran, is because of this petrodollar situation. They threatened to not accept U.S. dollars and to start accepting rubles and other currencies, gold and so forth. And additionally, Obama sees this as a way to underpin his legacy, if you will. So he sees this as a way to keep Iran from leaving the fold in terms of the petrodollar, but also perhaps being able to control that situation, which is mindless. You cannot control a country that is a state sponsor of terror, and it's just not going to happen. So, yes, we are opening Pandora's box and handing them $150 billion to continue doing what they've always done, sponsor terror, and they're going to continue to build the bomb.
The last phrase of your subtitle of your book, How the U.S. Navy Can Defeat Putin, is and halt climate change. Tell me about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mentioned earlier that we're only going to be able to survive with innovation. And I know a lot of folks are saying, well, there's no such thing as climate change. Let's set that aside for a second. Climate change will defeat us whether we believe it or not.
Or whether it's man-made or not.
Or not, because you still have a very strong environmentalist organizations in this country who will continue to push toward pulling the rug on petroleum and so forth, and that will weaken our economy. Well, how do we solve this problem all the way around? What we do know is that the ocean is absorbing a tremendous amount of carbon, and we have a serious problem with pollution. We see this in China and Russia. So the Navy has invented a way to convert ordinary salt water into any kind of fuel, jet fuel, petroleum, diesel fuel, unleaded gasoline.
That's amazing.
It's incredible, and it works. I went out to Washington, D.C., and I met with Heather Willhauer, the director of this program, and it does work, but it's nascent. It needs a Manhattan Project kind of push behind it. They are only building it to fuel the fleet. We could use this to basically pull the rug on all these oil countries because we don't need to go find oil. We could halt fracking, make the environmentalists happy.
It sounds like hydrogen fuel, William, is it?
Sort of, yes. Basically, it extracts carbon from the ocean. There's 140 times more carbon in the ocean than the air. So it will actually lower our carbon footprint. That's a good thing, make everybody happy. And it combines it with hydrogen, so it's plug and play. But the real key here is that it could create literally hundreds of thousands of jobs, maybe millions over time, and perhaps add trillions to our economy. We would be in the driver's seat supplying the world's energy because we could lower our upstream costs. That's the biggest cost for oil production. The oil companies could actually embrace it.
And an endless supply, salt water.
An endless supply, salt water.
My God. What a great novel idea. That is amazing.
It's a stone's throw from Washington, and not a single politician or presidential candidate has mentioned it.
Or has probably gone out to see it.
Nobody's gone there. I'm the only one.
That is great technology. It really is. It's amazing. Can people email you through your website?
Absolutely. They can pop up to the website, wcraigreed.com, and contact me through the website, and happy to respond.
And Reed is spelled R-E-E-D. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls with you, Craig, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, back with William Craig Reed as we talk about his book, Cold War III. And are we in this Cold War now, Craig, or we're headed that way?
We are absolutely there, and it's not as cold as it seems. You know, there's some heat going on.
It's heated, yeah.
On all sides of the fence, no question.
Well, so you're saying we've got some rougher times ahead.
Well, we do, and we are actually very close to some economic issues. Again, we're being propped up by this thing called the petrodollar. And as Russia and China continue to fire volleys, we've already seen two big hits to our stock market just from a couple of moves that the Chinese have made. So imagine what might happen if they get a lot more serious and perhaps even gang up against us with Putin. You know, look at what could happen to our stock market with several more of these volleys and a much, much longer and bigger play than they've done.
Why aren't we well-liked?
why aren't we doing anything, or why aren't we smart enough, or, you know, why are we allowing this to happen? You know, we're $20 trillion in debt. We don't really have much of a choice. We're doing everything we can to prop this thing up by trying to keep the petrodollar alive. And that's what we're seeing happen with all of these moves in the Middle East and, you know, the backing off with Putin. But again, the way to do it is not to capitulate. We must stand strong. It's riskier. But if you don't have a leader willing to take the risk, then we're going to see what we're seeing now.
Who got us in this mess?
Well, actually, it was President Nixon.
Really?
Yes. This was back in the early 70s.
Gold standard?
Yeah, the gold standard. Exactly right. He pulled the plug on the gold standard. Now, at that time, we had about 80% of the world's gold. And, you know, Fort Knox was where we kept this. And
now there's nothing there.
We didn't want to continue to have this gold issue because people were cashing in gold and we were kind of playing the banker for the world. And we couldn't spend willy-nilly like we wanted to. We had to stay honest. So to not have to stay honest anymore, we pulled the plug on the gold standard, cut a deal with the Saudis, and we said, we'll protect you from your enemies, including Iran, if you will accept only dollars. And we will also ensure that we keep your oil in great circulation. And so they saw this as a nice deal, and they took it, and the other OPEC companies followed suit, and that's the way it's been for 40-plus years.
Okay, so that was with Nixon, but what happened then with the Arab oil embargo in the 70s after Nixon that really ruined Carter's presidency?
Well, again, the OPEC countries still have some control, as we're seeing now, and they have done this across the years where they have basically sent us a signal that says whenever we get out of line or we renege on any of our agreements, they're going to either do embargoes or they're going to glut or they're going to do something else. And so, you know, this has been this little
tit
for tat thing going back and forth for 40-plus years.
Let's go to Washington State. Art's with us west of the Rockies. Hello there. Go ahead, Art.
Yes, good morning and good night, Art. It's indeed a pleasure to be on with the Paso Profundo of the Strange and Bizarre.
Indeed I am.
your host, your guest, sounds like he's a student of the military, therefore I would believe he's a student of history. And I would like to ask him if we had a missed opportunity at the end of World War II if we had not followed the Patton Doctrine, you know, While we have the personnel there,
take out Russia.
It sounds a little bit, for lack of a better term, mean. But we would have had basically our foot on the neck of the world.
What do you think of that, William? Patton may have been right. Go right in and take out Russia. We had nukes; they wouldn't have done anything.
Well, actually, Russia had nukes pretty close. We weren't absolutely positive they didn't. They actually had spies at the Manhattan Project, and they had nukes within a breath of us. And so there was some concern that they may have already been there, or it would have been a prolonged war. Now, again, we have to look at what happened with Hitler. He thought, well, let's just march in there and we'll just take over Russia. You know, they've got pitchforks.
Big mistake.
Big mistake. So, yes, it looked tempting, absolutely tempting, and yes, there may have been the possibility we could have done that, but, we had just fought a long and bloody and expensive war. We were at the end. We just didn't want to send more of our soldiers over there and spend. We just didn't have the funding, for one, and so it was really a tough call. But
or the heart for it.
Or the heart for it, correct.
And look what happened to Napoleon when he did the same thing.
Exactly. Russia's a tough, tough place to go and try and win.
Art, thanks for the question. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx right now on Coast to Coast. Hey, Joe.
How are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask your guest, besides the manipulation of the price of oil, are there any other ways to economically constrain Vladimir Putin in Russia? And also, among the candidates running for president, which one do you think, if they win, is the most manipulatable by Putin?
Well, great question. So, yes, there are definitely ways. We must stand strong. We still have the best military. They're catching up, and they've got a lot of formidable weapons that give us some pause. But Putin is making some tremendous moves in the Arctic, and we're doing nothing. We're not standing up to anything that they are doing. China's building sand islands. You know, we're taking a swat at them and saying, don't do it. We're mad. You know, we're not really standing up to anyone and telling them that we are going to take some serious action. We're letting them cross boundaries all the time and doing nothing.
Well, aren't they letting us do the same in terms of, you know, going into Iran, doing what we do? I'm going into Iraq, going into Libya, and doing what we did there. I mean, it's almost as if we've carved out the world, and we just basically say, that's for you, this is for us, leave us alone.
Yes, I agree, and I think, again, as I mentioned, we look at Ukraine, right? We actually started that by pushing to have Ukraine become a NATO country. We need, you know, it sounds tempting to do that. Is that a way to, you know, push Putin closer to doing what we want? No, he's not going to accept that. We're seeing the reaction from that. We can't just make these chess moves without thinking through the consequences of the moves. That's the problem that we're having right now. And then when that happens, we then step up and say we're going to be strong, and then we're not. We capitulate. So we can't keep doing these kinds of things.
A good chess player knows several moves way in advance. I'm not sure we're headed that way.
Putin's a tremendous chess player. Anyone that we have on the board right now who is running for president, none of them, in my opinion, are very good chess players.
I would agree with that. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Wayne.
Yes, I wanted to just speak a little bit. There was a show that used to come on called One Step Beyond.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that, George?
You're going to talk about that water pill that turns gasoline?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, that was in World War One, not World War Two. World War One. So the United States has known since World War One that we don't need natural gas, coal, oil, any of that. So what they're doing is they're fighting over something that the world doesn't even need, which is completely foolish. And also I want to talk about the misinformation and disinformation going on in the United States, such as they keep saying that Russia invaded Crimea. The Russians did not invade Crimea. The Crimean people took a vote, a referendum, and over 90% of those people voted to join Russia. Also, the United States installed the government that's in Ukraine right now, which consists of fascists and Nazis, right on the Russian border, knowing what the Russians went through with the Nazis in World War II. So what I would suggest is that everybody stop playing the one-up game and the I'm superior, you're inferior game. That's going to lead us to nuclear destruction for the whole planet. And can you comment on that? Can your guest comment on what I'm saying?
He sure can. Go ahead, William. And he may
be
right.
Absolutely. We'll take that comment in two parts there. We've had substitutes for oil and gas for decades. But anything that threatens the oil industry is not going to happen because the economy rolls around that, and that's just not going to happen. However, we can have ways, as I mentioned earlier, that I point out in my Cold War III book that the NRL has invented that will reduce upstream costs that they can embrace and also help our economy as well as perhaps, make the environmentalists happy. On the other side of the fence, we talked about Ukraine. and absolutely agree. We do have a tendency to do these kinds of things, again, because we are poor chess players. We can't be making moves that we think, well, we'll just do this and they're going to have to do that. We completely misinterpret what the moves are going to be because we don't understand who our opponents are. We don't know how they think. We don't know how Putin is, and we should. We've seen enough of what he is capable of doing, his KGB background, and so on. And Ukraine is a very good example of that.
All right, let's take a few more calls here. Wayne, thank you for yours. We'll go to Joel in Montana, west of the Rockies. Joel, go ahead, sir.
Yo, I'd like to make a comment. The man called in and wanted to know why we didn't take out Russia when we had the chance there at the, or with Patton, right, poised where he was at the end of World War II. This I heard from, was revealed when after we knocked the wall down, the Russians shared this. At the end of World, or before Russia took Berlin, Stalin pitted two of his biggest armies against each other to take Berlin. One of them was commanded by Zhukov, and he's the guy that won. The other guy, I couldn't pronounce his name if I knew it. The two guys went after Berlin, and this was revealed by the papers from Russia, that they killed more men, over 600,000 men. They were so anxious one against the other. I think they killed more of each other than they did the enemy.
My God.
They weren't careful about where they were. They were just shooting their artillery and everything. And so can you imagine an American army the size that we had at the Meuse there at the Elbe when we met the Russians to go through two of his armies? You know, first we would have had to have taken Berlin unless the Germans would have surrendered to us, then gone through two of Russia's biggest armies, far bigger than whatever we had. I mean, it's just unrealistic to think that we could have taken over Russia at that time. It's just totally infeasible. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Unless we used nukes, but the problem is, did Russia have them too? That could have been a problem. At least they didn't really have a delivery system, though, William, did they? William, you with us? We've lost him again. So we'll try to get him back. We only got a few more minutes left, so I'll keep getting your comments. Charles in Baltimore, welcome to the program, Charles. Go ahead.
Yes, how do we know with all these deals we made with Iran that they wouldn't try to do a nuclear attack on us by surprise?
Well, you're assuming that they have nukes right now, but I do not believe they do. And that's been the big issue right now. The big question is you cut a deal with them, what's going to happen when they do get nukes eventually, or the capability of doing it? Can you trust them? The jury's out on that. I don't think you can. Wayne in Maryland, first-time caller. Hi, Wayne. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm doing great. You struck gold tonight with having William Reed on there. I just started reading his book, and it's outstanding, the Red November book. The stuff that he writes about and discloses during the Cold War, it knocked your eyebrows off. Nobody knows this stuff. I wish Craig Mr. Reed a lot of luck with the book and request that he hold on to the movie rights. This would make a great documentary. It's silent service and high drama. So, and I'm not related to Mr. Reed either.
Okay, great. And he's back with us, I believe. William, you're with us now?
I am.
Wow. Bopping all over the place here. Anyways, he was complimenting you on your books.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Take a few more calls here. Cody in Tennessee. Hey, Cody, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, George?
Okay, great.
Hey, I just had two brief questions for your guest related to the Cold War topic, I suppose. What do you think the perception of the United States is politically as compared to, say, But let's take late 1960s, for example, where at least in the free world, the United States was viewed as kind of the liberator from the menace of communism. And moving forward today, it seems that we have, you know, through our various military operations and police actions, so to speak, across the globe, it seems almost that world sentiment is turning against us as it did to the Soviets. And I wonder that over the, you know, medium term, 5 to 10 years, if that doesn't impact our ability, or I should say, if it doesn't contribute to our decline and presents more of a threat from the Russians, I guess. How do you think that the world is, or the United States is seen by the world today as compared to, you know, say 30, 40 years ago?
Oh, far more dismal today. We were seen as liberators. And in fact, we were sitting on cloud nine after 9/11. You know, as devastating as that was to us, it did polarize this country. And we actually had the opportunity to once again truly lead the world, and they would have followed. In fact, we started to do that, and then unfortunately we went off the rails, we went a little too far, and you know, after that we've gone downhill, especially over the past several years, because we're now perceived as weak, that we don't keep our word, especially with what happened in Syria. I mean, my gosh, the Middle East, those countries were shocked. The comments coming from the leaders in those countries about the backing down in Syria, really, really bad.
Where does this all take us, William? Of course, you've only got a minute left to answer the question of the century. Are we going to go to war with Russia?
We might, unless we get a leader who knows how to properly negotiate and play chess. That is potentially inevitable, and we need to innovate. What people don't understand is that the internet technology, you know, we've heard about technology robbing the blue-collar workers. That's ridiculous. It added $100 trillion to our gross domestic product, above what we had.
Well, great job with both works, Red November, Cold War III. Up next, Jason Martell joins us as we talk about the true possibility of a real Planet X.